42. His missingness. Aside from looking as though they all shop at the Gap and nowhere else, the inmates of Volkov's rendering farm don't seem to be required to wear a uniform. Case sees several in the halls as she's leaving with Big End and Parka Boy, and several more as they make their way to the guest house. The fence she'd climbed, Big End says, has been only recently installed to prevent teenagers from the surrounding countryside from sneaking in to pilfer things. There are usually 60 people here, he says, fulfilling their debt to Russian society by rendering, as they have been taught to do, the rough segments of footage that arrive from the Moscow studio. The physical plant, formerly a technical college, is intended to accommodate 150, which accounts, she supposes, for its dozy summer session atmosphere. What sort of crimes did they commit? She asks, scuffing along in her slippers, Parka Boy carrying Volkov's gift. Nothing violent, Big End says. That's a requirement. Generally, they simply made a mistake. What kind of mistake? Miscalculated the extent of blat required, or who had it, paid off the wrong official, or made the wrong enemy. Sergei's recruiters keep track of court calendars, sentencing. It's essential to get them before they've been exposed, literally, to the standard prison system. Then they undergo testing elsewhere, medical and psychological, before coming here. I suppose some don't make it. Moths are whirling around the light atop a steel pole beside the concrete path, and the sense of being on the summer campus of some down-at-heels community college is eerie. What happens when they graduate? She asks.
I don't believe any have so far. The facility's quite new, and their actual sentences are generally of 3 to 5 years' duration. It's all being made up as it goes along, as are many things in this country.
The path climbs to a sparsely planted grove of young pines, screening a one-story orange brick building that resembles a very small motel. It presents them with 4 identical entrances and 4 windows. Ornate white lace curtains are drawn across the darkened windows, but there are lights on above 3 of the doors.
You look bagged, Parka Boy says, handing her the cloth-covered rectangle. Get some sleep. I know you're exhausted, Big End says to her. But we need to talk, if only briefly. Don't let him keep you up, Parka Boy advises.
He turns and enters one of the doors without using a key. She sees the lights come on behind the lace curtains.
They aren't locked, Big End says, leading the way into the one to the left.
An overhead fixture comes on as she shuffles in after him, bandaged feet smarting. Cream walls, brown tile floor, hand-woven Armenian rug, ugly 40s-looking furniture in dark veneer. She puts the woolen package down on a bureau with a mirror whose borders are decorated with frosted grooves carved into the glass. She smells disinfectant or insecticide. She still has the envelope in her hand. She turns and faces Big End. Boone was reading my email.
I know, he says.
But did you know it before?
Not until after he'd called from Ohio to tell me we needed to go immediately to Moscow. I had a friend's Gulfstream pick him up and bring him to Paris. He admitted it to me on our way here.
Is that why he didn't stay?
No. He left because I no longer wanted to be in partnership with him.
You didn't? I mean, you don't?
No.
Why?
Because he pretends to be better at what he does than he is. I prefer people who are better at what they do than they think they are.
Where's Dorothea?
I don't know.
Have you asked?
Yes, once. They say they don't know.
Do you believe them?
I think it's better left unasked.
What was she trying to do?
Change sides, again. She really did want the position in London, and she'd told them she'd still be working for them as well, which I had discussed with her, of course. But when your email reached Stella Volkova and Stella replied, it caused a number of things to happen very quickly. All of the Armaz RU traffic is monitored by Volkov's security, of course. They immediately contacted Dorothea, who, in the course of what must have been a very intense conversation, realized for the first time who she had ultimately been working for and who she was in the process of betraying by coming over to my side. She must also have understood that if she could get to you first and discover how you had obtained that address, she would have something very important to offer them. She might even be rewarded and perhaps retain her job at Blue Ant as well.
But how did she know I'd gone to Moscow?
I imagine she'd instantly hired replacements for the last two, or perhaps there were more to begin with. I doubt if she ever called off your surveillance, even after Tokyo. She would have needed to continue reporting on you. She's a very imaginative woman in any case. If they saw you check in at Heathrow, they knew you were going to be landing in Moscow. There are no other destinations for Aeroflot at that time of the evening. She could easily have arranged to have you followed on this end. Not by Volkov's people, though. She still had connections from her previous job. He shrugs. She'd been posting on your website as someone else. Do you know that?
Yes.
Amazing. She had no more idea who the Maker actually was than we did, until they revealed it to her in an effort to facilitate her stopping you. But you're dead on your feet, aren't you? I'll see you in the morning.
Hubertus, Boone hadn't been able to get anything in Ohio?
No. He got the domain name from your email to Stella. He had the entire address, of course, but nothing he could do with it. By telling you he'd at least learned the domain in Ohio, he thought he might be able to garner partial credit with me after the fact. But in order to move as quickly as he knew we needed to move, he had to tell me the truth, all of it. He shrugs. You weren't telling me what you were up to either, but at least you weren't lying to me. How did you get that address, by the way?
Through someone with NSA connections. I have absolutely no idea how he got it, and no way to ever find out.
I knew I'd picked a winner as soon as I met you.
Do you know where Boone's gone?
To Tokyo, I imagine, to that designer girlfriend, the one he stayed with when you were there. Did you meet her?
I saw her apartment, she says, after a pause.
I think it's all actually about money for him, he grimaces. Ultimately, I find that that was the whole problem with most of the dot-com people. Good night.
He's gone. She sits down on the 60s orange bedspread and opens Victor Marchwinska Wirral's white envelope. It contains, on three pieces of blue bond paper, something that seems to be the précis or closing summation of some longer document. She reads through it quickly, struggling with the translation's peculiarities of syntax, but somehow it won't register. An account of her father's last morning in New York. She reads it again. The third time through, it begins to cohere for her. Wynne had come to New York to meet with a rival crowd safety firm. His patents would be secure soon, and he'd come unsatisfied with the firm he'd been developing them with. There were potential legal complications inherent in a move, and he had arranged to meet with the president of the rival firm in their offices at 90 West Street on the morning of September 11th to discuss this. He had, as the Mayflower bellman had always maintained, gotten a cab. Case sits looking at the license number of that cab now, at the Cambodian's driver's name, his registration, telephone. The collision had occurred in the village, the cab pulling south into Christopher. Minor damage to the cab, more damage to the other vehicle, a caterer's van. The driver of the cab, whose English was minimal, had been at fault. And she herself headed downtown by train to arrive early for her own meeting. How close might she have passed? And had he seen the towers as he'd climbed from the cab, the morning beautiful and clear? He'd handed the cab driver $5 and gotten into an off-duty limo, the Cambodian anxiously copying the limo's plate number. He knew that Wynne, his fare, would know that he had been at fault. In court, the driver had lied successfully and gotten off, and then he'd lied again to the police when they'd interviewed cabbies looking for Wynne, and again to the detectives Case had hired. He'd picked up no fare at the Mayflower. He hadn't seen the man in the picture. Case looks at the name of the Dominican driver of the limo. More numbers. The name, address, and telephone number of his widow in the Bronx. The limo had been excavated from rubble 3 days later, the driver with it. He had been alone. There was still no evidence. The unknown and awkwardly translated writer concluded that Wynne was dead, but there was abundant evidence placing him on or near the scene. Additional inquiries indicated that he had never arrived at 90 West. The petal falling from the dried rose. Someone raps lightly on the door. She gets up, stiffly, unthinking, and opens it, the blue papers in her hand.
"Party time," says Parkaboy, holding up a liter bottle of water. "Remembered I hadn't told you the tap's a bad bet." His smile fades. "What's up?"
"I'm reading about my father. I'd like some water, please."
"Did they find him?" He knows the story of Wynne's disappearance from their correspondence. He goes into the bathroom and she hears him pouring water into a tumbler. He comes back out and hands it to her.
No.
She drinks, splutters, starts to cry, stops herself.
Volkov's people tried to find him and got a lot further than we ever did. But he's not here.
She holds up the blue sheets.
He's not here either.
And then she starts to cry again, and Parkaboy puts his arms around her and holds her.
You're going to hate me, he says when she stops crying.
She looks up at him. Why?
Because I want to know what Volkov's Polish spin doctor gave you as a souvenir. Looks to me like it might be a set of steak knives.
Asshole, she says, sniffs.
Aren't you going to open it?
She puts the crumbled blue report down and explores the beige envelope's flap, which she finds is secured by two tiny gold-plated snaps. She lifts it, works the fabric back. A Louis Vuitton slimline attaché, its gold-plated clasps gleaming. She stares at it.
You'd better open it, says Parkaboy.
She does, exposing in tightly packed rows white-banded sheaves of crisp new bills.
What's that?
Hundreds, brand new, sequentially numbered. Probably 5,000 of them.
Why?
They like round numbers.
I mean, why is it here?
It's for you.
I don't like it.
We can put it on eBay. Somebody in Miami might want it.
What are you talking about?
The briefcase. It's not your style.
I don't know what to do with it.
Let's talk about it in the morning. You need to get some sleep.
This is absurd.
It's Russia, he grins at her. Who gives a shit?
We found the maker.
She looks at him.
We did, didn't we?
He leaves her the water. She uses one fingertip to gingerly close the case, then drapes it with its beige dust cover, carries the water into the bathroom to rinse with after she's brushed her teeth. Sitting on the bed, she removes the slipper, seeing that her left foot has bled slightly through its bandages. Her ankles look swollen. She takes off the cardigan, rolls skirt thing over her head, and tosses them both over the attaché and its obscene tray of cash. She turns down the bed, turns off the light, and limps back, crawling in and pulling the orange spread and the coarse sheets up to her chin. They smell the way sheets can smell at the start of cabin season, if they haven't been aired. She lies there, staring up into the dark, hearing the distant drone of a plane.
They never got you, did they? I know you're gone, though.
His very missingness becoming, somehow, him. Her mother had once said that when the second plane hit, Wynne's chagrin, his personal and professional mortification at this having happened, at the perimeter having been so easily, so terribly breached, would have been such that he might simply have ceased in protest to exist. She doesn't believe it, but now she finds it making her smile.
Good night,
she says to the dark.